Committee of Higher Education Workforce Development will be in order. Today's date is Tuesday, February 19th. Well, good afternoon. Today we're in for a treat. As you all know, we have a special guest. We have Daphne Kohler with Coursera, who is going to talk to us about MOOCs and the vision of Coursera, as well as really to give us a broad overview of this whole landscape, we're hoping, and most importantly, to be a catalyst for discussion, because we, in this committee, are definitely open to engaging in what is the future of this type of education for Minnesota and how we might act consistent with the potential for MOOCs to be a catalyst for true and meaningful change when it comes to both cost, access, and completion rates. And so before I turn it over to Ms. Kohler, I would like to draw your attention in your packet to some legislation. And so that's Senate File 548. This legislation is not before us. This committee will be taking this up on March 7th, but I wanted to make sure it was before us as we have this discussion, because believe it or not, there's a little something in Minnesota law that were we not to pass this, we wouldn't even be allowed to have this type of course offered for free in Minnesota. So thankfully, Senator Miller is authoring this bill, and we'll be able to handle that this session, but did want to bring it to your attention so that we have this before us as we have this discussion. So with – oh, yeah, go ahead,
Madam
Senator
Chair,
Lurie.
You opened with we were in for a treat, and I got a little – you know, last week we had a whole bag of chocolate in front of us.
For balance. So you thought I was coming back.
This is great. I love this committee. And I mean, no offense, but the bag of chocolate was really wonderful.
Well, where is that chocolate?
So,
well, Senator Lurie, that does remind us to thank everyone who brought treats for Valentine's Day. But I'm telling you, by the end of today, you will agree.
Okay, this is better than a bag of chocolate.
Well, it's at least a unique treat.
Don't set up expectations.
Okay, so with that, Senator, thank you. Daphne Kohler, go ahead.
Hi, everyone. So thank you for that generous introduction. And in addition to being the co-founder of Coursera, I'm also a professor of computer science at Stanford University, and that in some sense was the beginning for a lot of what you're going to hear about today. I'm going to try and keep the presentation part of this brief so that we have a lot of time for questions and discussions of whatever is on your minds. So you can co-founder Andrew and
Ms. Kohler, Dr. Kohler, could you make sure you're talking into the microphone so we get it recorded?
Sure. Is this better?
Yes,
okay.
It is. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. So my co-founder Andrew Ng and myself were both professors of computer science at Stanford University, and we've been working in online education in our roles as Stanford instructors for the past 4 or 5 years with the dual goals of providing a better education to our on-campus students, as well as to providing education to the millions or maybe even hundreds of millions of people out there who don't have access to this kind of quality education and making it more available to people everywhere around the world. And that effort culminated, I think, in what was a transformative moment in higher education that happened in September, October of 2011. When Stanford put out three courses, fairly advanced courses in computer science, freely available to everyone around the world. And the amazing thing was that within weeks, each of those courses had an enrollment of 100,000 students or more. And to clarify what the implications of that, the largest of those courses as a Stanford course is the one taught by my colleague Andrew Ng. It has an enrollment of 400 students every time it's offered at Stanford. It's considered large even by Stanford standards. When that course was open to everyone, it had an enrollment of over 100,000 people. So for Andrew to reach that same size audience, he would have to teach his course for 250 years. And I think it was that sort of realization that led us to the conclusion that there was this unbelievable opportunity here to affect massive change in terms of access to education to students in the United States and outside of the United States. And that was the sort of starting point for what ended up being the Coursera effort. So as of, we started this out as an independent effort in January of 2012, so we've been going, as strange as it might seem, for just a little over a year, and I know people think we've been doing this for 3 years because of all the media attention and stuff, but really it's only just been a year. In that year, we have been fortunate enough to partner with 33 universities who are offering 220-plus courses across a range of disciplines. I'll talk about that in a moment. We have, at this point, it's a slide that's hard to keep updated, close to 2.7 million students around the world. From 196 countries, and this is in less than a year because we launched in April. So 9 months, 2.7 million students have decided to come and benefit from this education. And I'll talk a little bit about the composition of this population later on. These are the universities that are currently working with us. We're very privileged to have a really outstanding group of institutions, both U.S. institutions as well as international institutions, public as well as private. And so you're going to see here, you know, University of Pennsylvania, Princeton, Stanford, and Michigan were our first four partners, Caltech, Columbia, Illinois, Virginia, Washington, Vanderbilt, Brown, Irvine, and many, many others. And I can tell you that there's going to be a whole lot more of them very soon. Soon, because interest in this is only growing both within and outside of the United States. Because of a mix of technologies that I'll tell you about in a minute, we're able to offer courses across a range of disciplines. People typically think about this in the context of online courses. They typically think of math or other STEM disciplines, but you can see here we have courses on philosophy, the social con. I guess they're very happy with what I'm saying.
Welcome to the Senate.
Usually Senates don't strike me as such excited places. The social context of mental health, global challenges, environment, business, medicine, photography, computer science. We have a course on astrobiology. It's really a very eclectic mix of courses that our university partners are able to offer via the Coursera platform. Let me talk a little bit about the student population, because I think that beyond the numbers, beyond those 2.7 million students, it's important to look at the individual stories of the students whose lives were completely transformed by having access to this kind of education. So here's one example from within the United States. A single mom getting into her 40s with two college boys and wants to get back to school. It's very difficult to do that while trying to raise a family, and so this is one transformational story. Three from outside the United States, which is where a lot of our audience is. Raul, who wanted to come and study in computer science and couldn't because there weren't any computer science programs in his country, took a bunch of computer science courses on Coursera, used that as the basis for a Fulbright scholarship, and is now coming to study in the United States. Wow. Jolene, who actually lives in Pakistan, took the Princeton sociology class and with a fellow student in the class decided that she was going to transform her life and found an NGO to help people in Pakistan. Achind, who learned how to become an entrepreneur by taking one of the Wharton entrepreneurship courses and is now competing in an all-India entrepreneurship competition. So these are some of the stories. I could sit here for probably an hour and a half and fill up the entire hour and a half with stories like that. I'm just going to tell you one more because these are the kinds of access stories that you expect. This one was a surprise to us. This is Daniel sitting on the right. Daniel is severely autistic. He has a speaking vocabulary of about 100 words. He communicates via typing on an iPad, a specially designed iPad. And he was the star student in the University of Pennsylvania poetry, modern contemporary American poetry class, which he did entirely online. And Daniel, who's 17, told us, as did his father and mother, that not only was this the first meaningful educational experience he's ever had after a life of special ed, that furthermore, the rigor of this kind of material, combined with a shorter attention span that I'll talk about, as well as the reduction in the amount of social interaction that he needs to do, really is actually alleviating the severity of his disease. And we hear that from a large number of autistic students. This is not the only such example. This is one that we were allowed to share. We hear that actually from a number of people with various other illnesses as well. We had recently, a couple weeks ago, from a stage 4 breast cancer patient who, because of chemotherapy, can't really leave the house to go to school, and this is the way in which she stays intellectually engaged and thinking about things other than her chemotherapy. So this is about access, and I'll come back to that at the end. So let me talk a little bit about what these, what the course experience in these MOOCs is like. So unlike a lot of open courseware that's been around dating back, 12, 13 years now, this is not just a bunch of static content. This is an active course experience. It is our attempt to bring to tens of thousands of people the kind of experience that you have when you're on the college campus. So the course begins on a given day. And every week, there is material that the students are responsible for learning. And every week, there's homework. And the homework is graded. And feedback is provided to the students. And if they don't do their homework, they don't get feedback, they don't get a grade. And that's actually an essential part of the learning experience in the same way that it's an essential part of the learning experience for our students on our campuses. And you can see the effect of deadline on this timeline where the x-axis is time and the y-axis is the load on the site. And you see those bumps? Those bumps are deadlines. Just before the deadline, everybody logs in to do their homework. So procrastination seems to be a universal phenomenon. And then the other aspect of this, which I'll come back to at the end, is that there is something to strive towards. At the end, the students get a certificate. And we'll talk a little bit about accreditation and credit at the end of the presentation. But even the very unofficial certificates that we've been able to offer to students so far, we have been told by students have gained them access to jobs that they would otherwise never have had access to. We've been told by people that they've changed careers on the strength of taking some of these courses and demonstrating to an employer as part of the application process that they were capable of doing a job that they're traditional academic credentials would not necessarily have made them eligible for it. I'll talk about that a little bit later. Okay, so now let me delve a little bit into the student experience, and there's really three pillars of that. The first is just the video-based instruction. Now, one of the things that happens when you move to video as a primary mode of instruction is that it breaks you away from the constraints of traditional college education. So you don't have to stick to the hour and 15-minute lectures, which we've had to do because of classroom scheduling constraints. So you can break up the material into these little bits or chunks of 8 to 12 minutes, which are much better suited to students' attention spans. And then students can traverse this at their own pace, at their own speed, reviewing stuff when they need to review it, as opposed to being forced to sit there being talked at the median pace for what is a population of 300 people in an auditorium. Now, in addition, this allows us to personalize the experience even more because you could add potentially background prep that might be required for some students but not for everyone, or optional material that might be useful of interest to some students but perhaps not of interest to the entire class. And so this allows us to break away from the one-size-fits-all model of education that's been forced on us by the need to scale instruction to a large student body in an auditorium. Now, video, and I'll show video in just a moment, but video is only a part of the student experience. It's only a small part, because a really big part is just the interaction that the student has with the material. And, you know, being educators, we looked a lot at pedagogical studies on what makes for an effective learning experience. And one such paper came out in Science about a year and a half ago, demonstrates that even simple retrieval questions that force a student to remember stuff that they had just learned is incredibly effective in improving outcomes on tests down the line. And you can see that it's much better than, say, reviewing the material, which is the gray bar in the middle. So we've built in interaction with the material in a variety of different ways. Here is what the student experience looks like. And I'm not playing the sound because it's not necessary right now. The instructor is talking, and you can see there's subtitles and everything for accessibility. When the video hit that yellow notch, actually, let me rewind that a little bit. Hold on. So when the video hits that yellow notch right there, the student gets asked a question. Jeez. So the video pauses, and the student types in the answer to their question, or sometimes it's multiple choice or a calculation question. And this time they got it wrong. They have the opportunity to try again. I'll talk about mastery learning in a moment. And this time they got it right, and there's an optional explanation. Now, in fact, if you think about this, this is a more interactive experience than what students get in a traditional lecture class, because when I, as an instructor, ask a question in a lecture class, 80% of the students are scribbling the last thing I said. The back row is all on Facebook. And then there's the smarty pants in the front row who blurts out the answer before 90% of the class has even realized that a question had been asked. And then the class moves on, and pretty much no one is actually engaged with the question. Here, every single student engages with the question. So it's more interactive in many fundamental ways. But these little baby questions in the middle of a lecture is not where the real learning happens. The real learning happens in the weekly homeworks that I mentioned earlier. And so here is the dilemma, because, of course, if you have a class of 100,000 students and your institution isn't willing to fund 5,000 teaching assistants, how do you grade homework and provide meaningful feedback to students? And so we've actually put in two mechanisms in place, the first being that the computer is actually now pretty good at grading a variety of different types of work. So in addition to the good old multiple choice, we've seen short answer grading already demonstrated in the video. You could actually do pretty sophisticated grading of math expressions that is more than just checking for identity of what the answer that the instructor put in. And you could do some pretty in-depth work having to do with computer models, of physical systems or financial systems, computer programs, as well as grading of things like Excel spreadsheets, for example, for a marketing model. You can grade an Excel spreadsheet for correctness and for typical error modes, for example, and the computer can do that completely automatically, giving feedback to the students. Which brings us to an important point about this, which is, I think, one of the more valuable capabilities of an online learning platform to everyone, including our on-campus students. When you're an on-campus student, you submit a piece of work. If you're lucky, you know, you get the work back graded within 2 weeks, at which point it's probably about 4 weeks between when the material was taught and when you get the work back. If at that point you got 70 out of 100, 99% of students are going to say, darn it, I didn't get that, that's too bad. And they're going to go on to whatever it is they're learning now because it's what they're supposed to be learning now. The immediate feedback that you get from auto-grading naturally leads students towards a gamified approach to learning. That is, they get the 70 out of 100 immediately. And they say, huh, I could do better than that. And they try again. And they try again. And what happens is, and you can see that in this distribution, the blue bars is the score distribution for the assignment the first time it's submitted. The green bars are the score distribution for the same assignment at the final submission. So most students are just incentivized to try again until they effectively get a perfect score. Now, the natural question you might ask yourself is, well, okay, if they're just trying the same thing again and again, are they learning anything more than just how to do this one question? And so one of the things that we tested is, for calibrating for how well you did on, say, the third problem set, if you did this mastery learning thing, are you doing better on the fourth problem set? And the answer is that you are. So students who engage in this mastery learning actually increase their performance, not just on the current problem set, but also on the subsequent ones, which is, I think, an important component of improving learning outcomes for all of our students. Okay, so that's one piece of it, but that kind of auto-grading by a computer doesn't lend itself to the kind of open-ended critical thinking style work that you need, for example, in the humanities, as well as in the variety of other courses. And so in order to deal with that kind of learning, we've put into place a peer grading mechanism where students critically assess the work of other students. And each piece of work is graded by 5 other students relative to a grading rubric or very carefully defined set of criteria that are provided by the instructor of the course. And here what you see is the teacher is for the Princeton sociology class. The x-axis is the teacher score. The y-axis is the peer score. And you can see that for this class, which had a very well-designed grading rubric, a very close correlation between what the teacher would have assigned the piece of work and what the student graders assigned to that piece of work, which suggests that this is actually a reliable way of providing meaningful feedback to students in this kind of open-ended essay questions, which was what was used in this final exam. But this opens up more than just essay questions as a form of assessment. So here is the Wharton design class, where the final project was actually a week-by-week elaboration of a design project, starting out with a concept, moving into a prototype, and finally ending up with an actual design. And you can see that students, by doing this, got 5 pieces of feedback from 5 students in each of the 8 weeks of the course. So by the end of the course, they had like 40 people commenting on their work. And some of them ended up with really amazing designs. So here are some of the final projects that were derived in this design class. And there's a laptop table with a vent and some, you know, places to store the cords. There's a little charger that I wish I had, because in most hotel rooms, the charger is never next to, you know, the power outlet is never next to a piece of furniture where you can put your phone, and a space-efficient desk and workspace. And one of the things that I think was worth noting that I honestly didn't plan for, I just picked these ones because I liked them from the final project, they're from 3 different continents. So there's one from India, one from Spain, and one from the Philippines. And one other comment about peer grading, which was a surprise to us. We put in peer grading primarily as a mechanism for scalability, for scalable grading of open-ended work. The thing that was surprising to us is the extent to which students actually learned as much from the peer grading process as they did from grading their own work, from doing their own work. Because having done the work, their mind was primed to think about the question, and all of a sudden they saw 5 completely different solutions to the same problem they just worked on, which shows them there's different ways to approach the same problem, which I think is a really good way of teaching creativity and open-ended thinking. The final aspect of peer grading is that it really builds a social community around the material in the classroom, because it sets up open discussion around the assignments. So in the modern and contemporary American poetry class from the University of Pennsylvania, the work as well as the peer comments were posted on our discussion forum. And you can see here that for this example essay, 60 students then posted additional comments on that one student's work, and it was viewed by 872 people. So this is a real way of, you know, creating an intellectual community around around the work. Which brings us to the final pillar of the student experience in these courses, which is the community. Students interact with each other both electronically as well as physically in the context of these open courses. So electronically, we have a discussion forum where people post questions and other people post answers to those questions. And there's a lot of, and so effectively students are engaging in peer teaching, not just peer grading. And we have comments from students such as this one who tell us that these forums are actually more interactive and provide a better spirit of cooperation and sharing than most face-to-face classes that they've taken. And here is one of those places where, counterintuitively perhaps, larger classes are actually better than smaller classes. We all aim at our colleges of having small classes, low instructor-student ratio. Well, here's one of those places where the more active students you have on the site, the lower the response time to questions on the forum, because there's more people to answer questions. And anecdotally, the quality of the answers is better, too. And so in some ways, we actually now encourage these open classes to be larger because it gives rise to a better student experience. The other place where interaction happens, and this emerged organically, is students who come together physically and meet once a week to discuss the course material. We currently have about 1,800 communities in close to 1,600 cities where people come together once a week and they help each other over the challenges of the material. So again, engaging in peer teaching, which is a way of substituting for the more personal attention that an instructor can give, which just doesn't scale to 100,000 students. Okay, so now we're getting to one of the interesting questions that comes up about these courses. Okay, so the students learn, and learning by itself is wonderful, but what tangible benefit beyond that do students get at the end? And so I'm going to talk a little bit about credentialing and credit and some of the work that we've done towards that. So this is generation 0.1, if you will, of credentials. This is what Stanford let us provide in the fall of 2011. It's a statement of accomplishment. It's not a credential. It's signed by the instructor to the class and has a lot of legal boilerplate at the bottom saying this does not confer Stanford credit, the student identity is not verified, there was no academic integrity implied, and so on and so forth. That's the first generation. Nevertheless, even with that, we had academic institutions that, less so in the United States, but abroad, that were taking these courses for credit. Students would submit their statement of accomplishment together with a short report explaining what they learned, and they would get credit at their academic institutions. We can do better than that now. So about a month ago, we established what we call the signature track. The signature track is an identity-verified credentialing mechanism. Students, about 2 or 3 weeks into the course, when they're convinced they want to take it, they present a valid government-issued picture ID that's compared to their picture on their webcam. And a person at the other end says, yep, this is John Smith, sure enough. And at the same time, they create a biometric profile, which consists of their webcam image as well as a keystroke pattern, which it turns out is really hard to forge. It's very hard for one person to pretend to be another person by typing in the same way. It just doesn't work. So, and then every week when the work is submitted, the student is verified that it's they at the keyboard submitting the work. So you know that they're participating in the course, in the conduct of the course. They could, of course, still be copying the work off of somebody else, but that's true when we give homework at an academic institution also, sad to say. So, and then at the end, when the students do that, they get a more official form of credential. It doesn't have all that legal boilerplate at the bottom, and that carries the university brand. And it's still not for credit, but it's much more valuable to the students. Now, because of who we are and how we view things, this is now no longer free. There's costs associated with it, including the person at the other end who needs to verify the identity, for example. But nevertheless, because we think this is important for some students, we've put a financial aid mechanism in place. So students, by filling out a financial aid application for the signature track, get it for free. Currently, about 20 to 25% of our signature track students are financial aid, and we're just fine with that. Finally, and this is sort of the real next generation of this, for a subset of our courses, we have worked with the American Council for Education to provide what they call their college credit recommendation service. So for those of you who are not necessarily academics, the American Council for Education is a very highly respected, it's about 100-year-old, umbrella organization for U.S. academic institutions. All U.S. academic institutions belong to the ACE. They have had for over 50 years what they call the ACE credit program, which looks at non-traditionally taught courses. It started out, I think, in the military, but also exists in industry and government. So if you learn to be an electronics engineer in the military as part of your overseas training, you could now get that recognized for, say, 3 credit hours of introductory engineering credits. And the ACE does that, and there's about 2,000 colleges that are part of the ACE network that have the option then of recognizing that prior learning as being equivalent to college credit at their institution. So they're the ones that ultimately award the credit, are the institution where the student eventually enrolls as a matriculated student, because it's not the government or the military that's doing it. The ACE, since November, has been working with us to do that kind of assessment, that rigorous assessment of academic standards, on initially 5 of our MOOCs, 2 from Duke, 1 from Penn, and 2 from the University of from UC Irvine. And all 5, so actually the review is no longer underway. The review completed a week ago, or 2 weeks ago, I think. And all 5 of them were assessed as credit equivalent, 4 for college credit and 1 for what's called vocational or remedial credit. That's the introductory algebra course, which corresponds to roughly high school algebra. And here there is an additional layer of academic integrity. It uses proctoring via webcam. I can talk more about that if people care. It ensures that the students are doing a final assessment on their own without any assistance. And we're actually very excited about this development, because we believe that for the very large number of people out there who want a college degree and do not have one, this is a path back to college that is much easier than a lot of other avenues that are very difficult for them to follow as working adults, for example. And we can talk more about that in the discussion. Okay. So let me talk a little bit about some of the other benefits of this kind of open course, and I'm almost done, I promise. So first is that this allows us to turn the study of human learning from an anecdotal science into a data science, because we measure data at an incredible level of detail and at a massive scale. And so that allows you to answer questions both about what's working and what's not in specific courses, as well as about what's good pedagogy and what's not. So here, for example, is, in the context of a particular course, a distribution of wrong student answers. These are answers that happen to be pairs of numbers, so you can graph them on this plot. Each little cross is a one-off wrong answer, where a student came up with a particularly creative way to be wrong. the big ones are common wrong answers. So that big cross right up here, this one, is where 2,000 students got the exact same wrong answer. Wow. Now, if two students in a class of 100 get the same wrong answer, you'd never notice. But when 2,000 students make the same mistake, it kind of jumps out at you. And so Andrew, who happened to be the instructor and the TAs, went in, looked at what the students were doing wrong, understood the misconception. And now every student who falls into this bucket, whose answer falls into this bucket, gets a targeted error message, not just a too bad you're wrong, but a you're wrong and here's how you might think about how to correct your mistake. So it kind of personalizes the learning experience, personalizes the feedback. You can also answer questions more broadly. So for example, in online education, does having the instructor face show as a picture-in-picture, is that a good thing because it humanizes the video, or does that distract from the student's learning? I've read papers saying both things. So there's people who've said one and people who said the other. Well, we can now try it. So there's this thing in the internet industry called A-B testing, which basically every time you log into Google or Facebook or whatever, you could be one of that 10% of the population that's getting a different experience than everybody else. Mm-hmm. And then they measure outcomes like, you know, how often in Google, how often do you click on the top hit, for example, or on Facebook or whatever. There's certain performance metrics that they measure, and they see which population did better. And if the B population did better, then everybody gets switched over in a matter of days. So that allows this iterative improvement at a cycle of hours or days rather than years. We can now do the same for pedagogy, because you can have an A group that sees the instructor and a B group that doesn't. And you can see which of them have better learning outcomes. So in this particular case, we couldn't actually perform the experiment because a couple weeks into the course, the B group said, wait a minute, where's the instructor's face? And we can't focus because we can't see the instructor. And so we had to stop the experiment in the middle. But you can do this, and all of a sudden you can now improve pedagogy much more rapidly than we've been able to do before. Which brings us to the last point, which is improving learning outcomes. And there's two different ways in which learning outcomes could be improved. One is outside the classroom, what happens in the online environment, and one is inside the classroom. Outside the classroom, you can think of this technology as solving what is effectively a 30-year-old problem. In 1984, renowned educational researcher Benjamin Bloom wrote a paper called The Two Sigma Problem. In that paper, Bloom studied three populations. One is the people taught in a traditional lecture format. Not a very large lecture, about 30 to 40 people in the class. And this is their distribution of achievement scores. The second population were people still taught in a lecture-based class, but using a mastery learning format, which means they weren't allowed to move to the second topic before they demonstrated competence in the first one. Unlike what we typically do in schools, which is, okay, you're done with this class, you're moving on to the next one regardless of whether you got it or not. And the third one are people lucky enough to have had an individual human tutor. And you can see that the red graph is a full standard deviation, or sigma as it's called in statistics, shift in the distribution of achievement scores. And that the green population, the tutoring one, is two standard deviations, or two sigma. So to understand what two sigma means quantitatively from a learning outcomes perspective, if you take the midpoint of the blue population as your performance threshold, so people who are above that are doing okay and people below are not doing okay. So because you pick the midpoint, half are going to be above and half are going to be below. If you look at the green population and apply that same threshold, 98% of the students are going to be above that threshold. So imagine a learning intervention that moves 98% of students to being above average. Now, that would be really cool. Hence the two sigma problem, because as Bloom points out, if you read the rest of the title, the search for methods of group instruction as effective as one-to-one tutoring, because he correctly points out that as a society, we don't have the resources to offer a personalized human tutor for every student. But we can maybe give them a tablet or a smartphone, which now turns the question to a different one. Can technology move us from the blue curve to the red curve and ultimately to the green curve? Now, the nice thing is that mastery is really easy for a computer, because the nice thing about a computer is it doesn't get bored by explaining the same concept five times, and it doesn't even get judgmental. It's just fine with that. It's even fine with grading the same piece of work 7 times where most TAs would quit. So this is something that you could really easily achieve with a computer. Personalization, the kind that you would have with a personal tutor, is of course a much more challenging goal. But I think there's some hope in some of the ideas that we've discussed and some that others have already started to explore as well in letting people study at their own pace and giving them some personalized feedback and so on. So I think we might get at least closer to the green curve, or at least it's worth trying. The second place where improvement of learning outcomes can take place is in changing, or rather transforming, the way that we teach on campus. So this is one of my favorite quotes. It says, "The college is a place where a professor's lecture notes go straight to the student's lecture notes without passing through the brains of either." I don't think that's it's an unfair characterization of what happens in your typical lecture class. And so I think an alternative thing that we might do with our students on campus is going back to an even older quote by Plutarch, who said that the mind is not a vessel that needs filling, but wood that needs igniting. We spend so much of our time, the precious time that we as instructors sit in the same room as our students, basically filling their minds with content. And maybe what we ought to be doing is actually engaging with them in a dialogue that's going to ignite their passion for the discipline, their imagination, and also build creative thinking skills and problem-solving skills. Now, people smarter than myself have made that point before. This is Nobel Prize-winning physicist Carl Wieman at the University of British Columbia, wrote a paper in Science 1.5 years ago that compared lecture to active learning in the classroom, and compared on 3 different learning outcomes: attendance, engagement, and learning as measured on a standardized test. And for every single outcome, active learning in the classroom, where the instructor doesn't lecture but actually has a dialogue with the students, they talk to each other, they solve problems in the class, gives rise to much better outcomes on every single metric. So to summarize, and this is actually an analysis that was done by one of our Coursera instructors, Christian Torwisch from University of Pennsylvania Wharton Business School, who said that what MOOCs are doing for us in terms of learning is they're moving the Pareto optimal curve. So if this is the traditional Pareto optimal curve, where you can trade off between the amount of time that a faculty spends on each student and the learning outcomes of each student, so the more time, the better the learning outcomes, but then, of course, the higher the costs. He says that what MOOCs are doing is moving the entire curve to the right. And we can exploit this curve in different ways. We can keep faculty effort the same and improve student learning outcomes by, for example, doing active learning in the classroom. Or we can keep student learning the same and offer education to huge numbers of people at what is effectively a 0 marginal cost per student, which is what the MOOCs are doing, or anything in between. And so it's up to us to decide how we want to exploit this curve and where do we want to be for different populations of students. So I'm going to end now with Education for Everyone, which is the title of this talk. And I'm going to talk first about the education for our own on-campus students. This is your typical college experience in many of the larger, certainly many of the larger state institutions. And the question is, can we move away from that to something that looks more like this, where what students do is they get the content offline, and or rather online via computer, and then they come to class and have that kind of discussion. And then moving outside the boundaries of our college classes, it's valuable, I promise you, a breakdown of our student population. And one of the things that we're currently seeing is that the vast majority of our current students are actually lifelong learners. These are people, in fact, who already have degrees. Some of them have advanced degrees. And what they want to do is they want to keep themselves productive in a world that's changing far too quickly for what we learned in college 15 years ago to still be everything we need to know today to be productive members of society. And so these are educated people who are becoming more educated, more productive, or just keeping themselves fresh. Now, I actually think that this graph, though, is misleading, and it's misleading because up until now we've had no credit-bearing classes. I think that as we start increasing the number of courses that do have the opportunity for credit, we're going to see more and more people who do not have degrees who are using this as a way of furthering their goal of becoming, of getting a degree and getting a better job on the strength of that. And then finally, you know, looking even further out, only about 1/3 of our students are in the United States. 28% are in Europe, and everyone else is in Asia, South America, and even Africa and Oceania. And I think that's wonderful because these are people who, by and large, have no access to education to speak of. Maybe a few of them do, but most of them don't. And this is a really priceless opportunity for us to help provide access to education to people everywhere and turn education from something that is a privilege of the few to something that's just a basic human right. And I think that will make the world a better place for everyone. So that's the end of the presentation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Really outstanding, outstanding presentation. I'm sure many of us around the table have questions. I could just start with just a couple. Could you explain your relationship with those universities when you say you've got, you know, these relationships and that they're offering your courses, and how does that work?
No, we're hosting their courses, I think is the right description. It's their courses, their content, their academic standards. They own the content. They retain all IP to the content. We're a hosting platform. Think of us like, you know, iTunes U, only for a much deeper learning experience than just videos, for example. And so we are, you can think of it as a hosting platform, an authoring platform, and a hub or a portal for high-quality education.
But so, for example, University of Pennsylvania, give me an example of a course you're hosting and then who's taking it.
Mm-hmm. So the University of Pennsylvania was one of our first partners. I think they've offered close to 20 or maybe even over 20 courses so far. They've been awesome to work with. I'll give you the example of their ACE-accredited course, which is an intro calculus course that's equivalent to AP calculus, the BC calculus. And it's, I expect, taken by a lot of high school students. I think it's taken by students at who are aiming to go back to college and would like to beef up their calculus so that they're competitive and they don't have to go into, say, remedial calculus. And I think it's probably taken as supplementary material by students whose calculus education at their current institution isn't quite at the standard they would like it to be. But that's calculus. That's one course. The gamification course that I mentioned at the very beginning is a graduate level MBA class from the Wharton Business School, and it's taken by a completely different population. It really depends. We have an intro poetry class that's not intro poetry, actually. It's not intro. It's a very deep poetry class by an instructor who's considered challenging even at Penn, who had 33,000 students register for modern and contemporary American poetry. So really, it depends.
So if I'm understanding this right, so that would be a Penn professor.
That's right.
It's his course or her course. You offer the engine to bring it to the global population.
That's right.
And at this point, does Penn give credit?
No.
Okay.
Credit is something that is, I think, a discussion that has started very recently. It was, to some extent, sparked by the ACE agreement that we had. but I think it's important to remember the timeline of this. We launched in April. April is effectively mid-April. This is effectively the end of the academic year for most institutions. Mm-hmm. Summer, nothing ever happens. So the conversations at most college campuses on what are MOOCs, how do you use them, to what extent are they credit-worthy or not, really started in September. And so that's, 4 or 5 months ago. I think it's a complicated discussion that takes time.
Interesting. I have more questions, but I'm going to spread it out. Go ahead, members. Questions?
Really?
So, go ahead, Senator Eakin.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and Dr. Kohler. Very fascinating, and you've debunked a lot of widely held perceptions that I've had here today. And talking about how it personalizes education, you're talking about the peer teaching, and the peer grading, and so on. It sounds superior to the methods that we're using currently in the classroom, using teachers. Now, I'm a teacher, and so I'm just wondering, is our occupation in jeopardy here? Is there
No.
What your thoughts are, I guess, on the role of teachers in the classroom, the traditional classroom setting. What do you think of that traditional
So,
Dr. Kohler.
That's a great question, and I'm glad you asked that because it allows me to state unequivocally that I don't think teachers are going to go out of business or become redundant. I think this is the online experience is a superior teaching experience to a large lecture class. Somebody, except if you're a really gifted teacher who can somehow engage 300 students simultaneously, and there are some, I mean, they do exist, but there are not that many of them. The experience for a student sitting in that auditorium is not a very engaging and interactive one. Somebody gave me a beautiful quote a couple weeks ago that distance learning starts in the third row. I think that's probably true. So I think that what we'd like to do is we'd like to take a lot of the more mundane stuff, the content that students have to have in order to have an intelligent discussion, we take that out of the classroom. And then in the classroom, we have that incredible sort of connection that can happen between an instructor and students that frankly happens relatively little in large lecture classes. But if you have a setting that allows you to engage with your students, walk around, say, oh, you should try it this way, and no, that's the wrong trajectory, why don't you think about it in a different way, that kind of connection is something that we have relatively little time for in the way we currently teach, and this opens that up to more and more teachers.
Thank you.
Dr. Kohler, when you talked about remediation, that really sparked a chord because we know, particularly with MinSCU, our community colleges, one of the reasons why, and as you even addressed, that why the graduation rate is less than we'd like is because students get discouraged when they have to do remediation. And apparently, you know, huge numbers have to come in with remediation needs. So it occurs to me that this really could be a viable option for young people prior to coming to particularly like in the math area. Can you address that and how you think that we could actually partner with MinSCU or other community colleges like that?
I think that's a great question, and I think remediation specifically is one of those really amazing opportunities for effective for affecting change because, as you said, I think over 60% of students enter who enter community colleges enter with some need for remediation, and of the ones who enter remediation, I think over half never emerge. They never actually get their degree, which is really a stunningly sad statistic when you think about it. So how can this help? Well, first of all, it can help by providing students something to get up to speed before they ever enter community colleges, whether it be as a dual enrollment program in high schools facilitated by a teacher, by something that they do over summers before they come into their freshman year, or for the adult student who, for whatever reason, didn't make it into college or out of college the first time, this is a way of addressing some of those needs to give them the confidence and the ability to complete their degree in a reasonable amount of time without going back and getting trapped in the same black hole they were in before. So that's sort of as separate from what happens within the colleges. But I think also within the colleges, all of those things that we talked about in terms of improving learning outcomes by letting students learn at their own pace and letting instructors now focus on the needs of the students where they need that help. So instead of standing and lecturing to them, they can do the work at home, and then they come into class, and the instructor can organize them into small groups based on whatever misunderstandings they might have, talk to them, explain to them, do the kinds of sort of much more intensive interventions that are helpful to maybe get those students sort of out of that, out of the places where they're stuck. So I think there's a tremendous opportunity there.
Dr. Kohler, do you have any partnerships with high schools?
We've had interest in high schools, especially now that we've had some of the more introductory courses come online. We've gotten a fair bit of interest in high schools, and we know that there's a ton of middle school and high school students taking the Irvine Algebra and Pre-Calc courses, for example, which are two of our ACE courses. One of the instructors told me that she was walking in the park and a bunch of really cute middle school kids came and hugged her and said, oh, you're the Coursera lady. You teach me algebra. Wow. So it was very cute. I think that this is something that's going to happen more and more as we have more of those introductory courses coming up.
We're talking about this session, and I think Senator Kent's working on that. Testing our high school kids with the test that would be actually required once they get to the community college so that we find out earlier where they are when they're not yet ready. Yeah. And then if we could have an opportunity to give them a chance to take a Coursera course and then try again. I mean, that would really be phenomenal. Yeah. Senator Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Kohler, thank you so much. Great presentation, very interesting. I learned quite a bit from it. My question for you, can you expand a little bit more? The focus of this conversation and the focus of this committee is on the higher education portion, but I think it's also important for us to talk about the high school students that are taking your courses, maybe trying to decide what they want to go into in college, and then also the continuing education portion for workforce development. Can you expand on those a little bit more,
please? Absolutely, and thank you, Senator, for asking those questions. So in terms of the let me start with the workforce development. I think there is a tremendous opportunity for the continuing learner here to basically, say you got a degree in a discipline that is no longer quite as marketable as it was when you went into it. Or maybe when you went into it to begin with, it wasn't all that marketable, but you made a wrong decision and went in a direction that wasn't what you really wanted to be doing. And I'll come back to that because that's the answer to your first question. Then I think this provides people an opportunity to basically retool themselves or reskill themselves because you now have the option. And we've seen people who do that. Let me give you one example. There was a woman who had been in media relations. She really didn't want to be doing that. She wanted to be doing something that she felt had a larger social mission to it. So she took a bunch of our medical school classes. Of course, she didn't become a doctor by doing that, but she got enough of the vocabulary that she was able to interview effectively for a job as a coordinator for medical clinical trials at a large hospital. And so now she's doing that, which is something that she finds much more rewarding. We know a lot of people have done that in the IT industry. They were trained as mechanical engineers, civil engineers, electrical engineers. There's fewer jobs like that to be had right now. They took a bunch of our computer science courses on Coursera, demonstrated skills sufficient for getting jobs in places, competitive companies like Facebook or Google or similar companies in Silicon Valley. So I think that there is a real opportunity there, and as we expand our curriculum, that opportunity will only grow to encompass other areas. Now, to your question about the high school students, I think a lot of high school students enter college with only the vaguest idea of what it is that's involved in becoming a psychologist or a linguist. Or, I mean, did you as a 16-year-old know what linguistics even was? I mean, I didn't. People think they know what psychology is, but by and large, they probably have no idea what it's actually like to be a psychologist. And so, or a biologist or a physicist or anything else. And I think people make choices based on very poor information, and that ends up with poor outcomes for them because it might not be the thing that they're really passionate about or good at. And one of the things that I really like about MOOCs is that it's an entirely risk-free exploration mechanism. You sign up for one, you try it for 3 weeks, you decide that it's not for you, it costs you nothing. It costs you $0, and it doesn't show up as a failure on your transcript. And so it really allows people with a mechanism to find out the thing that they like. The other thing that it does is something that I read about only fairly recently when I heard about it by talking to former Princeton president Bill Bowen, who had actually done a research study on this. There's this thing called undermatching, which is particularly predominant in underrepresented minorities, where they go to schools that are not as selective as the ones that they could actually be eligible for. And what's interesting is that when they do that, they actually perform less well than had they gone to the more selective institution that they could have entered based on their qualifications. And so one of the things that we hope to see here is that students, especially ones from less advantaged backgrounds, be it underrepresented minorities, be it first-generation college goers, are going to go and say, wow, I took a Princeton class and I made it through. Maybe I should consider going to Princeton or to the University of Minnesota or to a more selective institution and therefore succeed better in life.
Yes, Senator Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that again, just continues to amaze me. Dr. Kohler, can you talk a little bit about the funding? We know we hear these are free courses.
Yes.
But we also realize that nothing is free. So no. Can you talk a little bit about the funding portion of these courses?
Sure.
Please? Dr. Kohler.
Thank you. So as you say, nothing is entirely free. I think we have brought it to the point where the marginal cost per student is very, very low, which means we can actually make this sustainable using relatively small amounts of money that are collected from different sources. And so let me speak to some of the sources that we've started to put in place. So I mentioned earlier the signature track, which is the way by which students become eligible for this identity verified credential. That's not free. It's not super expensive. It costs something like, you know, $40 for some classes, $60 to $70 for others. So, you know, the price of a restaurant meal. And
Madam Chair, Dr. Kohler, we are in Minnesota, so not too many of our restaurant meals get up to that $60, $70.
Well, for two.
For two.
And if you go to California, I suggest you bring extra cash.
In greater Minnesota, those meals are like $20.
That's okay. Well,
I'm thinking, California. Where do you live?
Still, $60 for credentials, not that bad. I don't know. It seems reasonable enough. And so this is a way in which students can, I think, benefit from the having access to a better credential and by doing so help pay for sustaining the entire effort. And it's entirely optional. That is, access to the content is and will remain free. The statements of accomplishment that we've been able to grant before, those are still free also. So it's only if you want that identity verification as an add-on that you basically have to pay this modest amount. The second mechanism that we've put into place actually came to us. These are institutions that come and say, we would love to offer our students a course on machine learning or on gamification because it makes them so much more marketable when they graduate and look for jobs. But we don't have anybody teaching that content because it's hard to hire people in that area. And for a small institution, you just can't cover all of the useful things. So what they can do here is basically get the course as a four-credit offering that they then provide to their students sort of within their own umbrella where they set the academic standards and where they provide the credit to their students. And this is, I think, a really effective way for a small institution to expand its curriculum because one of the nice things about these courses is that they are designed to be self-running. So an instructor who teaches or is the instructor of record for such a class doesn't need to be expert in the material in order to facilitate the student interaction. They can be sort of familiar with it, but they don't need to be super experts. And then the third model is we've started to engage with employers who are looking to close a skills gap. And, of course, this exists more in some areas than others. In the IT space, it exists for sure. In the medical space, in some sub-areas of teaching. And there's a bunch of these where you can't hire people with the right set of skills. So here what we've done is, to the extent that we have relevant courses, students can opt in to being searched by an employer after having taken the course. And the employer then, for students who've opted in, they look at the resume that the student has uploaded, look at the scores, look at the softer people skills that the student exhibited, like how much did they help other students on the discussion forums, for example. Mm-hmm. And now the employer can reach out to somebody that they think would be a great match for the job that they're trying to fill and try and hire the person, at which point they can basically pay the same way they pay a contingency recruiter. And so that's a different revenue model that we've started to look at.
And Dr. Kohler, with that model, are there legislative obstacles in the way? I mean, as we, you know, we as legislators, as we listen to this, we're always looking at is there a role for what we do to make access and make this process happen with more ease?
Mm-hmm. So I think that there are things that that you can do. First and foremost is the bill that's currently proposed by Senator Miller, and thank you for doing that. I think that's a big step forward in making this more accessible to the residents of the state of Minnesota. But I think it is only a step in the direction that needs to be taken. So the bill currently specifically excludes courses that carry credit. I think it's an interesting question of whether the ACE credit recommendations fall under that or not. I personally would like to have an answer to that. But I think that the whole idea of allowing students to get credit for the work that they did is going to be of tremendous value in sort of effective change, affecting change. I think there's things that you could do proactively that have to do less with removing obstacles, but rather with facilitating this. Mm-hmm. So, for example, a lot of remedial classes are actually supported by the state. And it's not clear at the moment whether that kind of remedial class would be supported if offered as a MOOC, for example. Mm-hmm. Is it or isn't it? And is there a way in which financial aid to students can be applied more broadly than it is right now, for example? Because as it happens, for arcane historical legislative reasons that have to do with the law being written before there were MOOCs, students taking MOOCs cannot apply financial aid to, say, that $50 certificate. They can spend 10 times that or more on, you know, a course from a for-profit academic institution, but they can't spend the $50 on the certificate and apply financial aid towards that. So
very
I think there's some interesting opportunities to actually reduce taxpayer burden because these are considerably more cost-effective, while at the same time making the lives of those students who do not have financial means and do not pay $60 for a restaurant meal, making their lives better.
Very good. And with regard to the employer relationship, is there any barriers to...
I don't see any for that right now.
And Dr. Kohler, do you have staff that are attempting to make those connections happen right now in the corporate world?
We do. We are woefully understaffed for the many opportunities that we have open to us. And so this is something that we're going to have to grow in terms of having more people who are trying to make that happen.
Go ahead, Senator Kent.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to say, beyond fascinating, I think this whole thing is mind-blowing. You know, when you consider the way we've all been educated and gone through this process and you see the capabilities, it really is just phenomenal. So congratulations.
Thank you.
And thank you for bringing this to us.
Thank you.
What you were just talking about gets to sort of where I was thinking. Part of the mind-blowing part is how quickly this has all just exploded. I can only imagine what that's like to manage.
Surreal.
yeah. So strategically, then, what are you thinking about the opportunities in the areas that you want to concentrate on and where you think the greatest opportunities for growth and next steps are?
Well,
Dr. Kohler.
Thank you. I think that what we would like to do, currently we have 222 courses, I think, which by some dimensions is an enormously large number. It's certainly more. I mean, we are launching 105 MOOCs in quarter one of 2013, which is more than has been launched before ever. But I think that's still a very small number relative to the needs in education across the spectrum of disciplines and across the spectrum of different levels of ability. You know, the kinds of calculus course that you might want to offer to a Princeton or Stanford student isn't necessarily the exact same course you might want to offer to somebody who needs calculus remediation. And so I think a big priority for us is to build up a larger curriculum that spans different topics, different levels of ability, and for that matter, different languages. We are very proud to be offering the first non-English speaking MOOCs. We have two French language MOOCs, and coming up very soon, we're going to have some MOOCs in other languages, in Chinese, in Spanish, and down the line in other languages as well. And I think that, again, comes down to the open access piece. At the same time, I think we would like to be working together with the universities around the country and around the world in developing better pedagogy that leverages some of the capabilities that are emerging as part of this effort, and trying to think about what is the most effective way to teach those students who have the privilege, which many students in the rest of the world don't, of actually attending a high-quality academic institution. How do we teach them in the best possible way? How do we blend the online capabilities, which are really better at doing some things, with the availability of a teacher who is capable of doing something that no online teacher, no matter how gifted, has, which is the ability to understand the needs of the students in the class to the point that you could actually help them make, you know, break through whatever is preventing them from understanding the material. And I think that is something that we hope to work with our institutions on developing as well.
Great. Thank you.
Very interesting. With regard to credit, can you just share a little bit about if you were to give us some direction as to both where you think this ought to go and where, for example, in your discussions with the University of Minnesota, give us some insight where the whole accreditation process might go.
So I think there's different ways in which this might go, and the discussions, you know, are not just with the University of Minnesota. I think many universities across pretty much all states are struggling with the question of how do you merge MOOCs and accreditation, and how do you get students to have that value, that tangible value that they need in order to further their progress towards a degree. So one way to do that is simply to have institutions agree to accept the ACE credit recommendations. I think that's a very low-hanging fruit because these are courses that are rigorously reviewed by a committee of faculty members. They're reviewed for learning outcomes, for alignment between assessments and learning outcomes, for the rigor, the quality by faculty members in the discipline. And so I think for an institution to say, we will accept those, I think is a very reasonable thing. And I have to say, currently institutions articulate courses from a very motley collection of other sources that I don't think are necessarily all superior to what the MOOC currently offers. Some are, but not all are. The other aspect, I think, is I'm not sure that it's not, well, I think it might be a good idea for institutions that offer MOOCs to basically say, I'm going to accept those MOOCs for my own credit, so that if you're offering, say, these courses, for example, to dual enrollment as high school students, or for that matter, to adult learners who are looking to reengage with a degree, why not have those students walk in with the assurance that when they come to, say, the University of Minnesota or one of the Minsky colleges, that they will be assured that those credits will be recognized towards their degree. I mean, it's great for students if you let them do that. And I don't think you should let students take the entire degree as a MOOC, because I think they'll be losing out on a lot of the learning experience that happens as part of a residential education and part of the interaction that you get with that one-to-one with the faculty member. But some courses to give them a leg up, I think, would be really beneficial. Especially some of the Gen Ed and the Gateway courses that are really pretty much no one wants to own. And then I think that we're going to start seeing more and more people just adopting MOOCs internally for four-credit offerings that happen within the institution with instructor facilitation or as a blended learning offering. And
does it make much sense, Dr. Kohler, if your partnering universities are developing the content and providing, you know, and you're delivering them, and then not giving those kids, you know, credit when it's their own?
You know, I think there's different perspectives on this. So if you are one of those institutions that teach your students in a small seminar setting where it's the instructor teaching 12 students, I think these institutions say, probably with some degree of justice, that the kind of experience that the student gets on campus is qualitatively different than what they get as a MOOC, and they don't want those two credits, these two types of credit, to be confused. Mm. That being said, I think there are plenty of courses where, going back to the distance learning starts in the third row quote, where it's really not qualitatively different as an experience in some of those courses. And for those courses, I agree with you that it doesn't make sense to distinguish that.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Kohler, and I stepped in a few minutes late, so apologize if you've already addressed this. But you've got partner institutions. Are you really the platform for their, and so is there any reason why they wouldn't charge tuition credit for the MOOC? So, for example, the students enrolled at Duke, and the professor says, okay, we're going to use a MOOC for class. Is that any any different than going to a 300-person lecture hall? And is there something in your business model that prevents them from doing that?
No, in fact, sorry, am I supposed to be recognized?
Yeah, that's all right. Dr. Kohler, the tradition is you talk through the chair, but for the tape, we just say it so that we're clear okay. Who's talking, but you can forget
sorry,
it.
I'm not used to this.
Me neither.
So not only do we not prevent it, we encourage it. We encourage our institutions to dual purpose the content for internal instruction for a blended learning format. We don't charge them for it. We encourage them to use it. We think it encourages better content development on their side. And not only do we encourage them to dual purpose content, we in fact say that if they want to develop a course, at least even initially for purely internal consumption, that too is not something that we charge for, because our hope is that down the line they might decide that they want to open it up as a MOOC and let other students have access to it.
Thank you.
Dr. Kohler, are you able to share anything about, the university did, I don't know if Provost Hansen is in here. Is she in here?
Coming back later.
Okay, I know that she had mentioned, or it has been said that the university is considering doing, something with MOOCs, and so I certainly don't want to put you on the spot if you're not ready to talk about it. But anything you want to share with the committee as a preview?
We have had some really good conversations with the University of Minnesota. I think that, like many of the nation's top public institutions, they are seeing that this is an important development that I think they would like to contribute to. And so I hope that we will be able to have a deeper engagement with the University of Minnesota very soon.
Very tactful. Thank you. And, Director Pogemiller is here. And I would ask Director Pogemiller if you would just come to the table so we could just ask a question. And we won't keep you too long because we still have another issue on our agenda.
Madam Chair.
Director Pogemiller, thank you for bringing Dr. Kohler here. I mean, that was really... you offered that to us, and we are so grateful, and really it has been very inspiring time that we've spent here. Can you offer anything about, if you were to say what your vision is in this area or any thoughts about direction?
Well, Madam Chair, I think you're on the front end of this, and you're talking to one of the sources. And so I'm learning just as you are. And I think members, when this all started for Minnesota, was several months ago, where our law says we have to charge every one of her member institutions, there were 20 or 33 of them there, for every course they offer that any Minnesota student takes. We didn't even know how to do that exactly. And so when we did announce that we would maybe not enforce that law until you had a chance to think about this, I was contacted by Coursera, and they said, could we be helpful in talking with your policymakers about what might be next? And so that's where we're at right now. I'm sure that the bill that Senator Miller has is a good start, but I think you can do much more. And I don't know what it is exactly right now, but we're trying to facilitate discussions with the institutions in Minnesota, with Coursera and others. I think the chair is going to engage other potential providers or platforms. And so I'm going to be looking for your wisdom on this, and we'll try to facilitate it in any way we can.
And Director Pogemiller, have we ever looked at allowing other online courses that actually, for example, a university may charge and making those available to Minnesota students?
Well, Madam Chair and members, the law today says that if an online course is taken by a Minnesota resident, that we are supposed to collect a fee from the institution offering that. And aside from how do you ever figure out if they're doing that, you have to ask yourself if it's free, why are we collecting a fee from somebody as a state? And depending, in the case of Coursera as a platform, this was thousands and thousands of dollars. Hundreds of thousands of dollars, apparently. And so their choice would have been to shut it down, yeah, or just kind of say, catch us if you can. And neither of those seem very useful.
Do we know how many Minnesotans are taking your courses?
I should have checked, and I didn't. I'm sorry. We checked back at the time, but we have had, that was when we had 1 million and a bit students. Now we have 2.7 million. So.
Well, we'd love to know if you could let us know.
I will absolutely let you know. In fact, I could probably let you know by the end of the day. I could just send an email to my team and they'll get back to us.
Okay, thank you.
But yeah, I mean, there weren't a ton. I mean, we were talking about, I think, on the order of hundreds, not on the order of thousands or tens of thousands. But because we had 33 institutions, and because the law required that each degree program that those institutions offer courses under has a separate fee, which means that, say, if Penn has a medical school course and a Wharton business school course and an arts and sciences course, that's three different degree programs, even though none of them are actually for degrees, then that's like, you know, $7,500 right there. And when you multiply that by 33... that's where you get to very large numbers.
Yeah.
So,
Madam Chair, the day after this hit the newspaper in Minnesota, I was shoveling, and my next door neighbor, I won't give you her exact age, but she's a degreed person, professional, somewhere between age 40 and 50, yelled across the yard saying, well, thank God somebody understood something. And I looked at her and I said, what are you talking about? She says, I'm on my fourth Coursera course.
Wow.
So...
interesting. Well, Director Pogemiller, I know that you're engaged with Chancellor Rosenstone and Commissioner Casilius around the remediation issue. And so I think that is an area that this committee would like to explore, the potential for MOOCs as a remediation tool. So I'd like to put that out there. I see nods around the committee. And then, of course, I think we do want to make sure that we do explore the opportunity for credit and you know, and that will be in a dialogue in partnership with our institutions. So.
Madam Chair, this evening we're facilitating a conversation with faculty and Dr. Kohler just to start kind of easing into this to see how what people think makes sense and what doesn't make sense.
Great. So members, anybody else before we conclude this part? Very, very powerful afternoon. Thank you so much for coming and sharing with us.
Thank you very much.
And thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Well, now now we're going to change gears. And have a technology break. So we have an overview of the Higher Education Facilities Authority, and then the we have three governor appointees to speak to us needing confirmation to the Higher Education Facilities Authority. Let the record reflect there was a quorum.
I'm Mary Ann Remedios. I'm not using anything. Thank you. Right. Well, I'm wondering if the green light's on.
Ready, green light's on. Yes, very good. You. I'm trying to say your name properly. Mary Ann Remedios?
Yes.
Very
that's
good.
That's very close. Thank you.
Yes. So do say your name for the record again.
Yes. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I am Mary Ann Remedios, the Executive Director of the Higher Education Facilities Authority. At your request, I'm here to explain briefly what the authority does and how we are funded. The authority was created in 1971 in order to help private, nonprofit colleges and universities get tax-exempt bond financing. The authority issues bonds and then lends the entire proceeds to an institution. The loans are used by colleges to acquire, construct, or renovate buildings, acquire equipment, or to refinance capital projects. It is up to the borrower to repay the debt. The bonds are secured only by the credit of the borrower and any reserves or special guarantees provided by that borrower. The bonds are not a debt of the state and have no effect on the state's credit or debt limits. The authority is able to provide more favorable interest rates because of its status as a government entity. The interest paid by the borrower to the bondholders is exempt from federal and state income tax at this time. The operating expenses of the authority are paid from fees from each borrower in connection with this bond issue. The fees are supplemented by investment earnings on our operating reserve. The authority has never received a state appropriation for any purpose. Our statutory purpose is to provide a low-cost service to colleges and at no cost to the state. We therefore charge fees that are, together with investment earnings, just enough to break even. We're limited by federal tax laws as to what we can charge colleges in connection with our bond financing. Our enabling statute states that we could only have a certain amount of bonds outstanding at any given time. The statutory limit has been increased every few years at our request, most recently in 2010. The current limit is $1.3 billion. As of today, we have about $940 million outstanding out of over $2 billion issued since 1971. We have issued 194 series of bonds, with over 60 bonds currently outstanding. Each college makes its own decisions independently based on its needs and based on market conditions. Bonding activity, therefore, fluctuates from year to year. So far in this fiscal year, we have issued about $50 million in principal amount, mostly for refinancing at lower interest rates. Our financial statements are audited by an independent CPA firm, and copies of the annual report are sent to colleges, to our colleges, the Office of Higher Education, the Attorney General's Office, and others. There are two members here today for consideration by the confirmation by the Senate. Three other members are scheduled to appear before this committee on February 28 and March 5. Two members have terms that expire January 1 and therefore are not being invited. In addition, to round out to 10 members, we have two ex officio members, a representative from the State Office of Higher Education, and the president of the Minnesota Private College Council. I just want to double check and see if our third member has arrived. Ray here? No. We have Mary Ives and Mike Ranum who are listed, and unfortunately Ray Vinzant, who's scheduled for today, may be detained. I'm sure he'll appear at a future meeting. I'll be pleased to answer any questions you may have.
Very good. Does anyone have any questions at this time? Okay. Well, we'll call your Mary Ives and Michael. Thank you, Senator. We were told to be very brief, and I plan to be very brief. I am very pleased, though, to be invited to visit with you for a few moments. I am a...
Ms. Ives, actually, we have plenty of time, so don't worry about it. We didn't know how long our speaker would go, but say your name for the record, please.
Surely. My name is Mary Ives, and I'm a resident of Grand Rapids, Minnesota. I'm a self-employed rural businesswoman. I hold a real estate license, and I work in commercial development and property management. I was elected to a school board and served 9 years. I was also elected as an Itasca County Commissioner and very much enjoyed that position. I was appointed by the governor to the Minnesota Board of Architecture and Engineering and served the number of terms allowed, and I found that a very, very interesting area of service.
and had an opportunity to learn a lot about the architectural and engineering fields. I've served as the secretary, treasurer, vice chair, and chair of this Minnesota Higher Education Facility Authority in my previous terms. I'm also in my third year as the chair of the Board of Trustees for the College of St. Scholastica, and I was just enamored by Dr. Kohler's report today, and I report to you that we as a Board of Trustees spent 5 hours at our last Board of Trustees meeting talking about just these same issues. We think it's a very exciting time, and we hope that you proceed to allow this to happen in our state. I'm very involved in my rural community, and I serve on many different boards and foundation boards for the library, for the Minscu system. I serve on the Itasca Community College Foundation Board. Also am the development director for our Grand Rapids Area Community Foundation. I serve on the Governmental Affairs Committee of our Chamber of Commerce, and also on the Itasca Economic Development Committee. I serve with Minnesota Power on their Community Advisory Committee, and recently accepted work with the Rife Performing Arts Center to do some development for them. I think that my work in commercial development and my public experiences have allowed me to understand some of the construction issues, the financial projections that school districts go through and colleges go through. My work with the college obviously gives me some insight into some of the enrollment concerns and architectural plans. I also feel that I complement some of my other peers that serve on the board who come with a different skill set than mine, and that I am able to contribute to the discernment that we have to provide about the capacity of each of the projects that are brought before us. And I really enjoy this opportunity to participate at this level for private colleges. I'm very proud of the private colleges in our state. I think they are doing a very fine job in helping graduate very competent students in a very timely manner, and I think it's very important that we continue to provide this bonding authority opportunity for them.
Ms. Ives, thank you very much. I agree with you, and I think we're lucky to have somebody with your experience and expertise willing to serve, so we appreciate that. Any other questions for Ms. Ives?
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think the next time I do this, I do not want to follow Mary, because clearly I'm put at a bit of a disadvantage. My name is Michael Ranum. I currently work as the Chief Financial Officer for BWBR Architects in St. Paul. I joined the authority in August of 2002. And am currently in my third term. I also have served, as Mary has, as the vice chair and chair, and am currently serving as the secretary of the authority. I think the thing that I would want the committee to know about my background is prior to joining, well, let me say that differently. From 1988 to 1997, I served as the vice president for finance and administration for Augsburg College in Minneapolis. Mm. And in that role, really came to understand very clearly the challenges that face private higher education, and also came to understand very clearly the value of the Minnesota Higher Education Facilities Authority. While at Augsburg, I think I was involved in three or four different transactions, the most prominent of which was to finance the construction of the Lindell Library on the campus of Augsburg College. Without the tax-exempt bonds that came through the authority, we would have never been able to do that project. The bonding really provided a bridge between the current, the time we needed that project online, and the time when the donor pledges would become a reality. And the the help of the authority was critical in successfully being able to carry out that transaction. I did not have any detailed expertise in tax-exempt financing. I was an accountant by training, a CPA, and was a general manager. And what I got in working with the authority were experts in tax-exempt financing that was really important for me and the board of Augsburg College to have confidence that we were getting value for our institution. And so when I had an opportunity to serve on the board, I was delighted because I think that I very strongly believe in the mission of the authority. I live with my wife in Circle Pines. We now find ourselves in a very empty home. Both of our daughters are away at school. We have a senior at Concordia College Moorhead, and we have our oldest daughter is in her second year of school at the Des Moines University pursuing a Doctor of Podiatric Medicine degree. Mm.
Congratulations. I think that's me. Very good. Mr. Random, I have to ask, are you related to our my former colleague, Jane Random?
I think I get that question frequently, and okay. I think the short answer is no.
Okay. Well, we're lucky to have you, too. Thank you very much. And as I listen to it, it occurs to me that I wonder if the K-12 system, particularly the whole charter school area, has ever considered could access something like this, because it really is a wonderful service, and particularly the charter schools don't have access to the low interest rate that our traditional public schools do through the state of Minnesota. Yeah. So it's really a unique financing mechanism. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you. So, members, any questions? Entertain a motion. And your other gentleman didn't come? Well, this committee has established a tradition that we don't confirm without the people coming, so we're going to be consistent with that. And so if others want to be confirmed, then they'll need to work with our committee administrator, and we'll have to set up a different time for that.
Okay. Madam Chair,
I
move that the appointments of Mary Ives, Michael Ranum to the Minnesota Higher Education Facilities Authority are recommended for confirmation.
All those in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? Approved.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And Mr. Ranum is an Augsburg grad. There were Ranums at Augsburg when I was there.
Oh, very good. Well, we ended early. That's good. Members, thanks for your attention and participation and really a very interesting hearing. So with that, there being no further business before the committee, the meeting is adjourned.